ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to the world today. It's Thursday, the 2nd of April. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, the war isn't over yet. Donald Trump updates the US about the conflict in Iran. And liftoff for Artemis 2, NASA's first crewed mission in half a century.
4, 3, 2, 1, booster ignition, and liftoff. The crew of Artemis 2, now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
Watching the launch is insane. I remember watching the video footage of the Apollo missions back in the day, and being able to see it again now in my lifetime is incredible.
US President Donald Trump has used his national address to claim America is winning the war with Iran and maintain the conflict still has more weeks to run. In the 19-minute speech, he also blamed the high oil price across the world on deranged attacks by Iran, and he said the US will hit Iran hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks.
We are systematically dismantling the regime's ability to threaten America or project power outside of their borders. That means eliminating Iran's navy, which is now absolutely destroyed, hurting their air force and their missile program at levels never seen before, and annihilating their defense industrial base. We've done all of it. There's never been anything like it militarily. Everyone is talking about it, and tonight I'm pleased to say that these core strategic objectives are nearing completion.
That's US President Donald Trump there. Laura Tingle is the ABC's Global Affairs Editor and joins me. Laura, coming into this address, the White House collected quotes from administration officials to try and refocus attention on their stated goals of destroying Iran's missile, naval, and nuclear capabilities, and not things like regime change or oil-related objectives. Did Mr. Trump stick to that theme tonight?
Well, to the extent that he stuck with anything, I think you could say he stuck with those ideas. But I think there was this sort of hope or expectation that the president would essentially sort of say, okay, either mission accomplished, which nobody would have quite believed, or would have said, this is where we're going to go next with it. But in fact, he's essentially just continued what his mixed messages have been over the last week in particular, which is, you know, well, we might go in there even harder for the next 2 or 3 weeks, but it's basically we've had this absolutely extraordinary victory. So it doesn't leave anybody all that much clearer. There was some brief reference to the fact that they wouldn't let the Gulf states down. Well, they already have. It's unclear whether he will require or somehow try to resolve the problem in the Gulf before the US withdraws, but the signals are that he won't, that basically he's saying it's somebody else's problem. It's very much a withdrawal into the America First position, I think.
He was kind of careful to point out and reassure the stock markets and traders and also gas consumers in the States that this won't last very long. What's the political dimension, the domestic political dimension to what we heard from Mr. Trump just then?
Well, the political dimension is that he and the Republican Party are in very deep trouble approaching the midterm elections. I don't know of anybody who thinks that this is going to be a short-term hit on oil prices. Donald Trump tends to, as part of that America First view, just sort of say, well, we've got lots of oil and now we've got all this Venezuelan oil, which may or may not be true, but it's, of course, problematic Venezuelan oil as well. He's looking at the fact that America has lots of oil and saying, our prices will go down, whatever happens in the rest of the world. This is very strange thinking, which tends to not take into account the fact that global markets are global markets, and if the price goes up of oil in the rest of the world, it'll go up in America. And also, of course, we're looking at the potential for a very savage economic downturn if prices do stay at these sorts of heights. And he has not given a solution for how that can be overcome, given the amount of production that's just gone off stream, so that even if the oil ferry came in tomorrow and fixed everything, it would take weeks or possibly months to get going again.
I can't help but think about Australians who'd be filling up their cars to go away over Easter. What, if anything, has Mr. Trump said today which may give them cause for relief?
Nothing, I would say. He has not created any grounds for more certainty about the economic outlook or for the military outlook in the Gulf. We're still confronted with the possibility that the US may walk away from the Gulf, that Israel may continue to have a war with Iran, that Iran will clearly, I think now, at the very least, look to extract a toll from every ship that goes through the Strait of Hormuz. So it's not a pretty picture at all.
The ABC's Global Affairs editor, Laura Tingle. Well, ahead of the speech, Donald Trump was claiming Iran had asked for a ceasefire. Iranian media quickly disputed that claim. The US president also scaled up threats to pull the US out of NATO if European states do not help reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Rachel Mealy has more.
5 weeks into the conflict in Iran, the US president continues to provide updates on social media. In an overnight post, he claimed the Iranian president had asked the United States for a ceasefire. It was swiftly rebuffed on Iranian state television.
The foreign ministry says that Trump's statements about Iran's request for a ceasefire are false and baseless.
In the United States, as the president's primetime address drew closer, he gave a little preview of what was in it.
Tonight I'm making a little speech at 9 o'clock, and basically I'm going to tell everybody how great I am.
The White House briefed journalists about what to expect. Julia Manchester is the national political reporter at The Hill, an American newspaper and digital media company based in Washington, D.C.
We do have a rough outline. A White House official told reporters earlier today in the U.S. that President Trump is expected to announce the U.S. Could pull out of Iran or stop airstrikes in Iran within a 2 to 3 week time frame.
In recent days, Donald Trump has reiterated his criticism of the NATO security alliance. Overnight, in a social media post, he again described NATO as a paper tiger and said in an interview that removing the US from the alliance was now beyond reconsideration.
We know that the president has really been lambasting American allies over the past number of days for not aiding in helping the United States police the Strait of Hormuz.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer was asked about the speculation that President Trump was planning to pull out of NATO.
Firstly, NATO is the single most effective military alliance the world has ever seen. And it has kept us safe for many decades, and we are fully committed to NATO. Secondly, that whatever the pressure on me and others, whatever the noise, I'm going to act in the British national interest in all the decisions that I make. And that's why I've been absolutely clear that this is not our war and we're not going to get dragged into it.
Charles Kupchan is a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University.
Were Donald Trump to withdraw from NATO, it would be a geopolitical earthquake. It would dismantle the alliance that has, in many respects, anchored the Western world since NATO was created in the dark years after World War II. And it's not just a military alliance, it is in many respects a political alliance, an institution that reflects common interests and common values and a common commitment to liberal democracy.
While a full departure from NATO would require an act of US Congress, President Trump has the power to remove troops from Europe immediately. Professor Kupchan says a decision like that would rupture the world order.
In some ways, it would be a return to the much more chaotic, anarchic landscape that existed before NATO was formed in 1949.
Professor Charles Kupchan from Georgetown University, ending Rachel Mealy's report. I'm Andy Park. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on ABC Listen. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. The federal government is urging Australians to keep calm and carry on as normal amid the global fuel crisis as the Strait of Hormuz remains blocked by the Iranian conflict. In his national address last night, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese also urged people to think of others who depend on fuel and take public transport where possible. At the National Press Club today, he's spoken about his government's actions in building the nation's resilience and fuel security.
We were investing in Australia's economic resilience well before. the conflict in the Middle East began. And for our government, international uncertainty is not an excuse to delay or hold back reform. Australia will not find our future security in the past or by copying approaches from overseas. We have to invest in it, build it, and create it ourselves. We can, we must, and we will.
The PM at the press club today giving something of a reboot to Labor's reform agenda. For more, here's Kimberly Price.
In a rare primetime address, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese told Australians to feel reassured in his government's control of the fuel crisis ahead of the long weekend.
You should go about your business and your life as normal. Enjoy your Easter. And if you're hitting the road, don't take more fuel than you need. Just fill up like you normally would. Think of others in your community, in the bush, and in critical industries.
But on the streets of Hobart, some weren't convinced by the Prime Minister's approach.
I listened. Waste of time. Well, I didn't learn anything new.
He didn't say a lot, did he? I don't know why he had to bother, really.
And despite Mr. Albanese's message to continue life as normal, many say they're rethinking their fuel consumption.
I tend not to drive much anyway. I do have a bicycle, so I might just use that more, or my motorbike.
We always conserve fuel.
I actually just caught a free bus into town, so I guess that's something.
For Melburnian Ella Williams, the Easter break is usually a time to venture into the great outdoors.
All my mates and I usually go camping. It's been a bit of a tradition the last few years. We were going up to the Grampians this year, same crew. We're all pretty chill with our camping habits. We're not glampers at all.
But this year, she's cancelled her plans.
Yeah, I didn't want to make the trip all the way up to Halls Gap and then get stuck. I also feel a little bit conscious. I work in agriculture. I feel a little bit guilty almost if I'm going out to a regional town and taking some of the locals' supply.
Northern New South Wales farmer Mike McCosker is grateful people are rethinking their fuel consumption.
We've still got a fuel supply, but it's more the stress of not knowing whether we'll actually have fuel to plant crops or where things are going. The fertiliser side of things is really uncertain at the moment, so there's a lot of mental stress for farmers.
Opposition leader Angus Taylor has criticised the Prime Minister's national address, describing it as nothing but hot air.
It could have been a social media post.
While he doesn't want to see fuel restrictions, Angus Taylor says it's hard to know what to think without clear details.
What we need is regular daily updates of where are the gaps in the system, how's the government filling them, and how can we have confidence that we can get on with our lives in an appropriate way.
Angus Taylor will make his own address to the nation tonight. Meanwhile, the West Australian government has enacted emergency powers to force fuel companies to provide information about their supply chains so it can allocate fuel to where it is most needed. Alison Reeve is the director of the Energy and Climate Change Program at the Grattan Institute.
I think what we're likely to see is a bigger focus from all states on just making sure they've got a very granular understanding of where the fuel is flowing, because that does have an implication for the minimum stock holding, which is our current buffer against shortages.
She believes the government is taking the right approach in working to avoid petrol rationing.
We've still got that buffer of 30 days or so of fuel, and provided that the ships keep arriving with our refined fuel and with crude, that buffer holds out. The messaging is that rationing should be a last resort, and that also relies on everybody's individual behaviour going the right way. So I'm not sure what else they could be doing really at the moment.
The Grattan Institute's Alison Reeve, ending that report by Kimberly Price and Alexandra Humphreys. Energy producers are pushing back against calls to introduce a gas exports levy, warning it will drive investors away from Australia. The Middle East war is set to bring huge profits to the gas industry as prices surge. Groups ranging from unions to artists argue Australians should see a share. Isabel Massali prepared this report.
Hey Albo, it's Ben Lee. We know you love music, so we hope you're listening.
It's time to make polluters pay for the damage they're causing to our communities and to country.
Ben Lee is among more than 150 musicians sending messages like this to Australia's leaders.
We are calling on the federal government to immediately introduce a 25% tax on gas exports.
Green Music Australia is behind this campaign, following similar calls from unions, the Australian Council of Social Service, the Australia Institute and the Australian Conservation Foundation. Berish Balanda is Green Music Australia's CEO.
You know, I think that's modest, and at the absolute least we could be trying to get from these gas giants that are really largely responsible for the climate crisis that we all face and also are profiting from the wars that are raging around the globe.
The idea has support from the Greens Party and crossbench senators, including David Pocock.
A 25% tax on gas export revenue would be $17 billion a year, which could actually go into our future fund. We could use some of it for targeted cost of living relief for the essential services that so many Australians need.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers has stressed the government's position hasn't changed, but Labor has supported a parliamentary inquiry into the tax treatment of Australian oil and gas resources. Meanwhile, the industry is pushing back against the campaign for a gas export tax. Aaron Morey from the Chamber of Minerals and Energy WA says it would add to pressures that energy companies already face.
We continue to have world-class deposits. We continue to have significant resource potential here. But at the same time, we see the weaponization of regulations and laws by activists in the courts, very slow approval timeframes. We have a relatively high taxation burden.
And the Australian Energy Producers Chief Executive, Samantha McCullough, has issued a statement warning this is the worst possible time to consider new taxes on an essential energy sector. She said it would stop investment in new gas projects. Aaron Morey agrees.
The spectre of a significant new taxation arrangement in the midst of a global energy crunch, of course, is going to weigh heavily on the minds of those who decide where to invest around the world.
That's Aaron Morey from the Chamber of Minerals and Energy WA, Isabel Masali reporting. Well, despite the gloomy mood overseas and at home this Easter, tradition is tradition. And food is central to many Easter celebrations, and I'm not just talking about chalky eggs or hot cross buns. Sydney Fish Markets is gearing up for one of its busiest days of the year tomorrow, with tens of thousands of people expected through the doors for Good Friday. Some shoppers were getting in early this morning. Rachel Hayter was there.
Mika and her auntie are looking for a nice snapper for Good Friday lunch tomorrow.
We came to buy some fish to get ready for tomorrow, Easter. Yeah. As tradition, my auntie, we are from Croatia, and I'm half Serbs, half Croatian, but she's always making that Easter lunch for the whole family. So we meet there and we all enjoy the beautiful food she prepares.
Auntie Juba prepares a traditional Serbian dish every year.
We usually start with some mussels, then we do snapper and bakalar. Bakalar is a very traditional Croatian meal which we made only for Easter, and it is a very dry fish. You have to soak in water and cook with a potato, and it's a very traditional meal we have for Good Friday.
1.5 kilo, thank you.
They're expecting 20 guests for lunch tomorrow, which doesn't faze Juba one bit.
Just cook this thing for the barbecue and snap up for the barbecue, you know, with the onions, parsley and all this, olive oil and all. I cook and I make some vegetable and that's all. I'm 50 and something years in Australia and I never miss Good Friday with the family.
Despite the dampener of the war overseas and what it's doing to prices at home, more than 60,000 visitors are expected through the doors of the Sydney Fish Market for Good Friday tomorrow. Big Easter seafood lunches spell a big few days of work for Carmelo Lombardo from Get Fish.
Very, very busy. You'll find that today's probably the second single busiest day of the year, being Holy Thursday.
Carmelo says fillets are proving popular so far.
Believe it or not, skinless, boneless fish fillets. A lot of people are asking for beautiful skinless, boneless fish fillets. And we've probably got around 15 to 20 different species which is great.
Further south in Victoria, Melbourne's Queen Victoria Market is also a hive of activity. Nat Tripodi from fruit and vegetable seller Queen's Harvest has the perfect side dish suggestion for fish.
We have such a wide range of potatoes. These are actually one of my favourites, the Yukon Gold. Make an excellent potato chip, especially if you're having fish and chips at Easter time. Also love a King Edward potato. Great roasted.
With food prices predicted to rise, fishmonger George Malonis from George the Fishmonger says he's seen some shoppers spend less this Easter.
We've seen a lot less sort of bulk items purchased. So I think people are saying, okay, I've got five people on the table. I'll get 200 grams of, per piece and I'll get a kilo. In the past, they probably wouldn't have thought about that so much.
As for George's table this long weekend, he says it's a good idea to get lots of colours on the plate.
I'll probably go for some snapper, deep fry some calamari, and we'll do some fish fillets for the kids, some flathead or some orange roughy. Of course, cook some cooked prawns, oysters essentially, and I might sneak a crayfish in if I can.
Well, now I'm hungry. Fishmonger George Malona sending that report by Rachel Hayter. NASA's first crewed flight to the moon in more than 50 years has been successfully launched from Florida this morning. The four astronauts on board won't be taking any big or small steps on the lunar surface. But if all goes to plan, there could be boots on the moon in 2 years. And Australians are playing a major role in the realisation of that dream. Here's Angus Randall.
RS-25 engines lit. 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition. And liftoff. The crew of Artemis 2 now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
Most Australians have only ever seen grainy archival footage of a moon launch. Today, the space race blasted into the 21st century. First, the massive rockets, filled with more than 2.65 million litres of fuel, ignite, sending Artemis 2 skyward. Within seconds, the astronauts break the sound barrier.
Confirmed as Integrity and its crew go supersonic. Approaching 90 seconds into the Artemis 2 mission. Integrity is 14 miles in altitude, 8 miles downrange, traveling more than 2,600 miles per hour.
The rocket's boosters, drained of fuel, then separate and fall back towards the Atlantic Ocean. Minutes later, the massive central engine also runs dry, breaking off and returning to Earth or burning up in the atmosphere.
Time standing by for main engine throttle down to 85% ahead of solid rocket booster separation.
The Orion capsule is now in orbit around Earth, ready for another fuel burn to push towards the moon.
3 minutes, 50 seconds into the flight of Artemis 2, Wiseman, Glover, Cook and Hansen cross the boundary to space with good comm checks.
The four astronauts will spend 10 days in space, testing life support systems and the Orion capsule. On day six, they'll get as close to the moon as anyone has been since 1972, around 6 to 10,000 kilometres from the surface. And if all goes well for the mission, the astronauts on board could fly the furthest away from Earth that humans have ever been. Dr. Catherine Sullivan flew to space 3 times and is the first American woman to walk in space.
This is really a shakedown and a test flight for the Orion capsule and all of its systems. It's not flown in space with people aboard it before.
NASA Associate Administrator Amit Kshatriya says there was a minor loss of communications during launch and a small issue with what could be the most important device for the astronauts.
We had a controller issue with the toilet when they spun it up, so we got to work through that. That's going to take maybe a few hours to troubleshoot.
The Artemis crew includes 3 Americans and a Canadian. The 3 NASA crew members have all been to space before, while it's the first time off-world for Canadian Jeremy Hansen. There are several other firsts in this mission. Victor Glover becomes the first African-American to travel to deep space, and Christina Cook is the first woman on a moon mission. They're all led by Commander Reid Weissman. Dr. Catherine Sullivan says despite being strapped to a missile, the launch pad can be a calm place for an astronaut.
You're just watching the countdown clock go down, you're listening to all the chatter amongst the engineers, you're eager and leaning forward, hoping everything goes smoothly and you make it all the way to the end and get to fly today.
Several Australian companies and universities are involved in the mission. South Australian aerospace company Southern Launch will be tracking Orion from the state's far west. Mission Systems lead Tyson Jones says it's a childhood dream to be involved.
I remember watching the video footage of the Apollo missions back in the day, and being able to see it again now in my lifetime is Incredible.
The next Artemis mission will conduct further tests in space next year, before Artemis 4 intends to land on the moon in 2028.
Angus Randall there, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. He's massing troops in the Middle East, but says he's winding down the war in Iran. So, will Donald Trump keep the conflict going or end it? Today, Kelly Greco, defence strategy expert from the Stimson Centre, on why whatever Trump's next move is, the chaos will continue. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.